everyone. I'm Haley Allam, and this is Mom Life in Luxembourg. If you're a parent new to Luxembourg, then this is the podcast for you. From crèches to crèmes, we'll cover everything you need to know about raising kids and living your best life in the Grand Duchy. Hi, Beth. Hi, Patricia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. So you guys are both psychologists, although you are also the assistant principal at Upper School at ISL. Is that right, Patricia?
That's right. I work in the field of student well-being.
Okay. So basically, the reason why this episode came to fruition is because you guys gave an amazing presentation about mental health for kids and teens for the ISL parents. And I actually kind of stole a couple slides and posted them on my socials and said, hey, would you guys be interested in a presentation or a podcast episode on mental health for kids and teens? And everyone was like, yeah, like I did a poll. It was like 100%. So I thought that we could have a little chat, basically going over all the stuff that you guys talked about in case you are an ISL parent or you missed it, or in case you are not part of the ISL community, but you are here in Luxembourg and you are an English speaking parent, which is what my show is all about. Before we launch in to all things mental health, can you each give me a little background about who you are and tell me your Luxembourg story?
I'm Beth Robertson. I am an educational psychologist. I am a parent to two wonderful teenagers who are 13 and 16. I came to Luxembourg a year and a half ago to work at ISL. We are coming from India. Before that, we were all over the US. And so this is the first time where we are going to stay somewhere for more than 4 years. So we're pretty excited to make Luxembourg a long-term home.
Awesome. Love that. Welcome.
I have been in Luxembourg now almost 20 years. So I'm a lifer.
Wow.
I originally came as a trailing spouse. My husband was transferred here. He's working in the space industry. I was working in the private sphere. And when I came here, then converted to working within a school environment. So I worked, the majority of my career has been as a counselor at the International School of Luxembourg. And then more recently moved into a different role within the school.
We're going to tap into your counselor role probably a lot here.
Once a counselor, always a counselor.
For sure, for sure. And we use it in every aspect.
Also good for you for coming as a trailing spouse and moving over to the educational side of things from the private sector. That's very cool.
Yeah, it's been a great journey. My son, who's also at ISL, was born here and goes to ISL now. So a parent as well as an employee there. And so I get to see all aspects of the school.
How long did it take for you to decide you guys were going to be lifers here?
We originally came for 2 years, as I think many people do. We were not yet married. We were engaged, and this was going to be our European adventure before we returned home and settled down. And we just fell in love with the place. I think for many people who've come to Luxembourg and experienced what Luxembourg's like, it's hard to leave. It's a place that kind of, yeah, you fall in love with. And so we decided, okay, well, let's stay a bit longer. And after 5 years, we knew we didn't want to be anywhere else. So we've been very fortunate.
Luxembourg definitely sucks you in, which is kind of amazing because the weather is terrible.
I come from South Africa. So by contrast, it was a big change.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about mental health in kids and teens. So there's kind of three things I want to cover. In general, mental health, how you can be proactive or preventative, I suppose, in your kids and teens' mental health. And then also what the warning signs are if things are kind of going sideways. And then if like red flag zone, what we can do about it and what the resources are here in Luxembourg. Mm. So I'll just take it from the top. I think you started your presentation with a question, which was, is it more important for kids and teens to have a supportive peer group or at least one adult who they can really confide in and trust? And the answer surprised me, but I was really happy because I have three kids and they're all over the map. But actually the answer is to be successful, it's actually more important to have an adult advocate or someone that they can trust or confide in for their long-term mental health. Can you explain that to me?
Well, this is coming out of research that Lisa Diamo put out there, and Adam Grant had her as a guest, and this was something that surprised a lot of people, that the biggest predictor of teen mental health, not necessarily success, but mental health, is having at least one caring adult, positive relationship with a caring adult. And this kind of flies in the face of what most of us see as most important for mental health for teens, because increasingly the peer group becomes more important from the teen's perspective. But as Lisa says, if you think about the teen that doesn't have a single trusted adult in their life, that is a teen that's really in struggle, that's at risk. If they don't have a single teacher, they don't have a parent, they don't have anyone in their life that's an adult that can guide them and support them, that's a huge risk factor. So having a supportive peer group is great, but in terms of supporting teen mental health, having a trusted adult in their life is more important.
So I don't have any teenagers, but what I understand is that as they get older, it's harder and harder to influence their life and control them. How can you influence their peer group, which it sounds like is less of a big deal, and how can you influence the adults that they choose to confide in? I mean, how can a parent really control that unless they are that person? But a lot of times, like, for example, my kids don't want to learn how to swim from me, you know?
So I think a couple pieces. When we look at it from, I spend a lot of time with the lower school, so our elementary from age 3 through grade 5. It's really about how do we build those relationships and have those conversations and starting it young. So if we can build those relationships with adults, starting at a young age, when they get to teenagers, they have that experience of a positive adult being someone. And you're right, it is tricky. I have 2 teenagers in my home. Sometimes they send me a message of, hey, mom, here's what's going on. And there's other times that they have a conversation with one of their coaches or another adult that they have a positive relationship with. And just being able to engage in that conversation with an adult of like, I know that you're going to accept me for who I am. And if I've made a mistake, you're not judging me. We may have a conversation about the decision or the behavior, but it's not about me. It's about the choice. And you see me as a person. And that is a big part. So we really, in the lower school, spend a lot of time talking about how are we developing relationships with kids, being there for them, meeting them where they are and seeing them as a person. There may be behaviors that we would like to change or pieces that don't fall in line with what we would like to see, but that's not them. That is a behavior. So really separating that. And an adult has the ability to really do that. And so we work with our team, and I know Patricia works with her team, to really encourage that kind of relationship in the school.
The word that you used there, though, you said, how do I control that? And I think that's something that's really important for parents to understand is that as their teens are growing, you can't control that. You can create conditions for it. But it's very difficult to control who a child connects with.
Yeah.
One thing that I think is really important, particularly for expat families, is that many of us are removed from our extended family. You know, the old adage, it takes a village to raise a child. We have to consciously create that community in that village for our child so that they have other trusted, caring adults that are not necessarily their parents in their sphere that they can turn to. They may not have as much access to their aunt or their grandparent or other extended family members. So really trying to create that kind of community around them and encourage them and help them understand the trusted adults that might be in their sphere that they can turn to. Because it's great if your teen can talk to you, but there's some things that they may prefer to talk with, you know, about with another trusted adult in their lives.
Absolutely. And you bring up a great point because, for example, my sons have done local sports, you know, and those coaches, not a chance they're going to be confiding in. You know, they're old school. They yell, they push, there's tryouts. You know, my 5-year-old may or may not make the basketball team. And same with schools. Like, as a parent, it's really hard to like interview the individual teachers that you're going to have and see if they will be a positive influence on your kid. And it actually just makes it even feel like an even bigger, more heavy decision about where to send your kids, because that's really the school and the extracurriculars are going to be where your kid is exposed to those adults. And like you said, when you have no village and there's no aunt, like you really just don't know until you try. So I guess is the answer here to really investigate the adults that are going to be around your kid, both the teachers, the coaches, and see if their culture jives with yours and see if they could be someone that your kid can confide to? Like, how do you figure that out?
There's 2 parts to that. One is around values, choosing a school that you feel matches your values, choosing environments that you feel would be positive for your kid and matches the values that you want to, you know, encourage in them. The other part is helping them become, particularly as they become teens, discerning about where they choose to take advice and who they choose to connect with. And that is one of the key developmental kind of milestones as you become a teen, is starting to think critically about what people are saying and starting to be able to guide yourself towards people, situations that are in alignment with your values, and not necessarily engage with people in situations as much that maybe are not in alignment with your values. Because ultimately, we're wanting our teens to be independent adults who are able to make those discerning choices for themselves while we're not there. It's a process of teaching them those skills as well.
Okay, so that's my next question. How do you teach them to be discerning in the adults that they interact with and confide in?
We really engage in the conversation at home about what are the values of our family? How does this align?
Are you literally supposed to have meetings with your family discussing your family values? Because I have literally never done that.
Families can approach it in different ways. My children, we've discovered in our home that if we sit down at dinner about once a week, we really talk about what's going on.
Once a week.
What does the schedule look like? What are some things going on? We celebrate one failure a week. Everyone brings a failure. We talk about it because it's really important that they understand that there's going to be failures. Our expectation is not perfection. And so it at first felt really tricky. And the kids were like, Mom, this is ridiculous.
Sorry, how old are your kids again?
13 and 16.
Okay. How old could you be when you start this?
So we've probably been doing about 5 years. And I would say now it's more organic. When it first started, we had to be real intentional about it as parents. I learned it in a parenting class that I went to a training to then teach, and they talked about the family meetings and the importance of not saying like, here's our family values, and never having the conversation about it. Because if you just say, here's this, but don't explicitly teach it and don't talk about it and help your kids understand the why of why having secrets with adults is not an okay thing, and that we can have conversations and there may be some surprises that we keep. Yes, the values are just written on paper, but if you really want them to internalize that, you have to model it, have conversations, really work through the prompting of it. And now I'm seeing the benefit of that, because when things happen out in the community or things like this, we can engage in that conversation. And even my kids will say, yeah, I can see where someone would say this, but you know, within our family, this is how we believe. And now my older one is starting to say, I know that our family believes this. Here's what I see. And she's really starting to identify her own piece. And so I think there's just a lot of pieces to that. But really starting that, it really took a lot of work for us as parents. But modeling that, engaging in that conversation has been a big game changer. And we don't eat dinner every night at the table like we used to, now that the kids are older and there's a lot of activities and there's just a lot going on. But we do really spend some time at the table having those conversations, and it really makes a difference. I hear a lot from the kids, and we're able to really engage in those conversations. And that's where I kind of can feel out where my kids are. If I see a big change in the amount they're sharing or things like that, then I'm like, okay, I need to check in with them, see what's going on. And we have some agreements. I'm a fixer, so they're telling me this, and I start going into problem-solving mode. They're like, Mom, you didn't ask. Is this a problem-solving or just a listening?
Oh,
okay.
Wow, they say that?
Yes. I just had this yesterday. Wow. And I was like, okay, I will just listen. But that started when they were in first, second grade. We started just modeling that conversation. And even between my spouse and I, we model that for the kids of like, okay, I just need you to listen. I don't need you to fix it. I just need you to listen. And so just that modeling of some of those communication, now that we've modeled it in our home, they're looking for that in friendships, they're looking for that in adults that they work with. And so just being able to model that has been a big piece in our house.
I love this so much. I do have to say that our family has two things: work hard and be a good person. And alums don't lie. Those are like the three things, but we don't like talk about them really ever. But this is a really great tip to do, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the preventative, proactive mental health stuff.
Just picking up on what Beth was saying about, is this, do you want me to listen or are you seeking advice? I think in talking with teens in particular, when we ask them, what are the barriers to you talking to your parents about this issue? One of the big things is that they are concerned about judgment or that their parents are going to tell them what to do. And so having conversations where instead of giving the advice or leaping to the point of here's what I think about the situation, guiding them through a conversation where they get to go through the process of problem solving themselves, and in that way, teaching them those skills of being discerning. So what that would look like is saying, well, what do you think about that? And what do you think the impact of that was on this person? Or so asking the right questions rather than having the right answers really builds capacity in young people. And that's ultimately what we wanted to do, is build capacity in young people, not tell them how to do it or what to do, because then we're not there and they don't have those skills.
I'm sure you're going to say this is a scaffolding thing, but my question is like, so when do you start that? Because as a parent, you know, you come out of the gates, they can't do anything. So you're used to problem solving and knowing the answer and just fixing it. And then at some point you kind of have to like step back a little bit, I guess.
Well, my child is much younger than Beth's. He's in second grade. Those are the kind of conversations I would have with him. So he would say, do you know what happened at school? This person said something to this person. And I'd say, oh, and how did they respond? And what do you think they felt about that? And what do you think about that? It's a conversation where what will come out of it of, well, I think she was really upset. I think that really hurt her feelings. Well, how would you feel if that happened to you? It's getting them to come to the conclusion that that behavior was not appropriate because it caused harm or hurt for somebody else, mm-hmm. not because the teacher says we don't call names. It's understanding that the reason why we don't call other people names is because it causes harm to the other. That builds empathy, that builds understanding, the foundations that go beneath values, so that when they're faced with a situation and they're older, they're not following a set of rules, but they're behaving from a place of understanding that this is the kind of person I want to be in the world, and this is the kind of impact I want to have on people, and that's why I choose to behave in this way.
Essentially, you need to turn it back on them. Instead of giving them the answers, you ask them to give themselves the answers.
It's super hard because I want to give advice. I love giving advice. A part of me feels that it's the parent role to tell them what to do and what not to do.
Yeah.
And so I have to really inhibit that in myself of not leaping to the advice giving first. And sometimes it's about validating how they feel about a situation and giving them a chance to express it in their own words and in their own way. But yes, I do think it's a skill of developing, becoming curious and asking questions rather than being the one that has all the answers.
I mean, I don't have all the answers, like just so,
and you don't need
just
to.
So we're clear.
You don't need you know? To. That's the wonderful thing.
I don't either. But I think this is also a time when this is a good opportunity for them to fail. There's a safety net. And if we don't allow kids to fail or experience things when they hit that first failure or that first tough situation, they also don't know what to do with their emotions or what they're feeling. And so as much as I want to protect my kids, and we have some neurodiversity in my house, as much as I want to protect them and make sure that like the day goes great for them, part of well-being isn't always having happiness, but it's what do you do when you reach those situations that are tough? Can you reach out to someone and have a conversation? Do you know what it feels like in your body? How are you able to express that? How do we help you get through it? Can you ask for help? There's so many pieces to that. And I think our role with young children, you know, we talk about a village, is really to help them. If they fail, how do we take a step forward, which is part of why we celebrate failures in our house and we model it as parents, but also apologizing when we make mistakes and being clear and transparent as developmentally appropriate. So like I say a different thing to my 13-year-old than I do to my 16, almost 17-year-old. So there's a lot of different pieces to that. And we talk about parenting in this time is tricky with social media and, you know, smartphones, and there's so many layers. And I wish that there was like a handbook, you know, that we got as a parent that says like, here's what to do. But for each kid, it's different. And so it's really about asking them questions, being open to the feedback and engaging in some of those conversations.
Just picking up on what Beth said there, I think one of the biggest myths around mental health is that it's about feeling good all the time. Often if you ask parents, what do you want for your child? They say, I want them to be happy. And it's a wonderful thing to want for your kids. But it's not necessarily an indication of positive mental health. And I really like the very simple definition of mental health that is about having feelings that fit the situation and having the skills to manage those feelings effectively. Because essentially, that's what mental health is. There are going to be times when you experience negative emotion, and that is healthy, and that's normal, and that's good. That's a part of life. If you are challenging yourself, you will experience frustration. If you have a loss, you will experience grief. And these are normal emotions that everybody experiences. And from a psychological point of view, someone that is happy all the time can actually be a cause for concern, that mental health is not about feeling good all the time. And I think that can take a bit of a burden off parents, that positive mental health means our kids wake up every day and every day is just sunshine and roses and unicorns. It's just, that's never been a psychologist's definition of what constitutes mental health.
I don't think anybody really expects that. I think that sort of the same as people saying like, hi, how are you? Like, I'm fine. You know, what do you want for your kids? I want them to be happy and healthy, you know? Mm-hmm. But really, of course, you want them to respond appropriately to the situation and be able to advocate for themselves and grow up and live independent lives. That's my goal anyway.
It's very interesting seeing your child struggle and being okay with that. I think one has to, as a parent, manage your own emotions around it. You have to manage your own desire to remove challenge or fix it for them. And I think for me personally, I recognize that challenge. If my child comes home and it's dealing with something that's difficult, to not want to remove that or fix it or take it away.
Yeah. Can we talk about a couple examples of that? Like, let's say that your kid fails and just doesn't turn in their homework. Like, you just let them fail and say, hey, like, if you can't figure it out, this is the life you're going to have. Is this something that you would celebrate as like a failure? And my other one is, what if there's, let's say a kid becomes frustrated and really overreacts. And obviously, I know you can't teach anything in the fight or flight kind of stage, but when it's calm, like, do you say like, look, I want to teach you how to react appropriately because that was over the top and like unacceptable. Tell me how you would walk through those kind of scenarios.
Should we each pick one? I'll do the first, you do the second.
Sure, sounds good.
Great.
Because Beth is fantastic with zones of regulation. I'm sure she's going to tell you a bit more about that. But in terms of the homework situation, it's really helpful to understand what's driving that behavior. I always say that we want high expectations with high levels of support. That's the ideal. So if a student is not doing the homework, understanding why that is would be very helpful in solving that problem. Are they not doing the homework because they don't know how to? There are barriers to it because they have executive function challenges and they have organizational difficulties. Are they not doing the homework because they're afraid they're going to get it wrong? The instructions are not clear. Are they not doing the homework because they have difficulty with boredom or dealing with things that are not enjoyable? There are many reasons why kids don't do their homework. So I think the first thing is to, with them, we come from a restorative practices lens at ISL, where we look at how do we work with kids? How do we understand, with your help, what's going on for you with this homework? Because it's a problem that it's not getting done. Helping them understand why it's a problem. For most kids, it doesn't feel good to go to school and not have your homework done, to be on the back foot, to maybe be in a classroom situation where, you know, you haven't done it and now you have to face the consequences for that. So I think there's a middle ground between, well, you haven't done it and now you face the consequences of that, and, well, let me fix it for you. And that middle ground is, let's together understand what's creating this problem and together come up with some solutions for how we're going to remove those barriers to getting that homework done. That's a collaborative approach that's teaching problem-solving skills. That's also helping both your child and you understand what might be going on for them, because behavior is communication. There's reasons why kids are behaving a certain way, and it's important, if we want to solve that problem, to understand what the underlying reasons are for that behavior.
It's hard not to be judgmental of your kid. If you know they're capable of achieving X and they achieve, you know, Y, you're like, what's happening, you know? And I think it's hard. I did write down the proactive, preventative mental health things that parents can do. Be non-judgmental. Listen. Teach them how to fail. Do you need to have a conversation of like, listen, I am here to listen if you want me to. I am not going to judge you. even though you sort of will, but you just won't tell them. How do you address that so that they understand that's the role that you want to play?
I think through actions. So we try to at least once a week take a walk with each kid individually, just have that conversation. Walks, car rides, when you're not face to face, tend to come out with the best. Walking side by side, when you're not face to face, tends to come out with the best conversations because there's not the eye contact requirement. There's not a pressure to engage in that conversation. So I think those are some of the pieces. If I said to my girls, hey, I'm not going to judge you, but these are the things that they would just look at me. So we've done it through just different ways. Their father's maybe not as comfortable with it. And so we talk about it. So there are some things that they talk to their dad about, and there's some things they talk to me about, but we've just embedded it as part of our family process and just allowing those times. And so last week, just with schedules, I wasn't able to take a walk with my older daughter. So this morning she was like, hey, we didn't get our walk last week. There's a lot going on. Can we take a walk tonight? Sure.
But wow.
We'll sort that out. But if I would have just said like, hey, I'm available for you to talk, but intentionally building in that time. And there's some walks where we walk and there's nothing said. And I say nothing about it. That's okay. And then we sometimes have to go on the walk twice because there's just so much to talk through.
Wow.
I think also, as Beth said, it's one thing to have that conversation with your child saying that I'm not going to judge you, I'm here to listen. But how you respond in moments where they do fail or they do mess up, I think speaks far louder than
just saying that.
When they have made a big mistake and you respond in a way that is, you know, still holds them accountable, still helps them understand the impact of their actions, but is coming from a place that mistakes are learning opportunities and I'm with you in this and I support you in this. I'm still going to have, you know, certain non-negotiables. But in those moments of failure or struggle or hardship, the way in which you respond to your child means, I think, a lot more than just saying, I'm not going to judge you if you make a mistake. I'm not going to get cross with you. I'm not going to be...
You have to actually do it.
You actually have to live it, which is, you know, there's that lovely quote about we have to be careful about the way in which we speak to our kids because that's going to become their internal voice. The way in which you behave really speaks more to them than kind of words that are just said in moments where there isn't any struggle.
Okay, Beth, tell me about the overreacting emotional frustration tolerance.
So I think there's multiple pieces to this. One of our favorite strategies that we teach at school, and it's one that I've used since grad school, is name it to tame it. I really encourage families to build their feeling vocabulary, to talk about different feelings, because if we're able to identify the emotion, even if in the moment it's just angry and that's the only thing the child's able to say, as a parent, you're able to say, okay, I know they're feeling this. We use zones of regulation. That would be a red zone, but helping them to understand the name of their emotion and the sensation that they feel in their body. Like when I get angry and I tell students this and my kids, I can feel it in my back. My back tenses up and I can feel it getting warm. I get goosebumps. I tend to, like when I get really, really angry, cry. I was like, these are all things that I feel in my body. In the moment, it's really important for a parent or the adult to co-regulate with them. If I'm cross as can be at my child, which happens sometimes, and she's upset, and I come at it with that emotion, I'm not the solid object. And mm-hmm. we talk about that solid object being someone that the kid can latch on to. When they're experiencing dysregulation, experiencing big feelings, they need to feel like that person is there to keep me safe. Sometimes that keeping safe looks like I'm going to set some limits. Okay, like you can experience that feeling, but I have to keep you safe. Sometimes that means I'm going to give you a hug, you know, if it's my own child. For a student, we set those limits so that they stay safe. But engaging in the conversation about what they should have done or could have done when they're still dysregulated actually can increase the dysregulation and limit your availability to be the solid object or the safe person. So we let them, okay, you can experience all feelings are okay, but reactions, not all reactions are. So it's really important because that brings it back to the behavior as opposed to the person. Mm-hmm. And so when there's that big dysregulation, sometimes as parents, we have to model, like once we know that they're safe, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to step away, mom or dad, or I just need a break. I need to take a deep breath. So I'm modeling and verbally prompting and using that as I'm working through that situation. And as Patricia said, like, I still have expectations. I still have, these are non-negotiables for me, but I'm going to support you to be in that regulation. And then we go back and say, okay, tell me what you were thinking. What were you feeling? How did this help you? Because sometimes their body feels like a volcano. We have lots of kids who tell us, like, I feel like I'm a volcano and I need to explode. And the way that they explode or get those big emotions out is through hitting something, pushing something, tearing something, because they need to just get that release. So, okay, so you need to tear something. Okay, I have a stack of papers, need to be shredded. Anytime you can come in here and you can just tear those up. So I'm preloading some of those things. Okay, you need to punch. Okay, well, here's your bed, here's a pillow. Because eventually we want to work away from that. But in the moment, meeting them where they are and being able to kind of safely do some of those things. Because what they're telling you is, I need a big physical movement out. So, you know, from an OT perspective, we talk about heavy work. Sometimes a kid needs to carry some heavy things from one side of the room to the other because they can feel in their body those sensations are starting to come up. So after, we're like, okay, did you notice beforehand when you started feeling angry? Oh, okay. So if we can get them to a point, even as an adult, I can feel, oh, my back is starting to get warm. I'm getting angry. I either need to take a drink of water, feel the water go in my mouth, down my throat, to give my brain just that moment to disconnect a little bit, so that I can recognize, ooh, I'm starting to feel angry. So we really work on, how do you feel that coming through? Is it always going to happen? No. Are there times when I get home and I'm feeling really angry? I'm not really sure why. I'm going to slam a couple cupboards. I recognize I need to take a step out. I think there's a couple of pieces in that: building feelings vocabulary, really talking about, like, how did you feel that in your body? Sensations, just that physical awareness. And what are some ways to get that out? Because sometimes you just need to get the emotion out. For some people, it's running. For some people, it's playing a sport. For some people, it's reading a book. For some people, singing. I have a friend who sings terribly in her car when she gets really angry at work. And so she'll go out to her car and I'm like, oh, she's in the car. She must have got upset. But I think, you know, as adults, we have the opportunity to move about, right? We talk about kids. Okay, if they're in school, they need to sit in a chair. I'm always on the go. If you see me sitting in a chair too long, there's something going on. So, you know, really allowing them to be in tune with their body and being able to develop those skills that are appropriate for the environment. So if I'm getting really upset and I'm feeling that, maybe I do need to take a stress ball and kind of pull at it, or I need to get a fidget. And so we really talk about, what are the tools you can use? So I think that there's multiple layers to those situations, and every kid is different. So you have neurodiversity in the mix. So for some of our students, it looks different depending on their needs. And I think this is where adults that are close to them, as we're listening, they're sharing the message of, what do I need for support? And the biggest piece for me is my village. I reach out. It's like, hey, this is what's going on. I don't want to make a big deal about it for her, but these are the things that are going on. Here's what we've done. So allowing the adults in her environment to also kind of know what's going on is that piece. So it comes back to the adult relationships that she has built as well.
I think it's so hard as a parent because you have to co-regulate them when they're kind of in the yellow or the red. Yep. And a lot of times you have your own nervous system that you're dealing with, right? I feel like we've done a really great job of covering the preventatives, right? Talk to me really quickly about the red flags or yellow flags that things are kind of going sideways. And then hopefully we can just touch on resources if you know it's code red.
This kind of segues beautifully from what Beth was talking about, because a lot of the red flags are particularly with teens that I would be looking at for coping strategies that are causing harm. So Beth's been talking about coping strategies that don't cause harm, that help you manage your feelings effectively. So some typical coping strategies that would be a cause for alarm or would be a red flag would be that they're using substances to manage how they feel, that they are causing harm to themselves in some way, that they are damaging relationships by the way in which they are managing their emotions, or they are using avoidance to manage anxiety. So those sorts of coping strategies that are not helpful would be kind of red flags that that child is struggling. The other thing, particularly with teens, is to know that their they will feel emotions intensely. That's part of being a teen, that their emotions will go high and they will go low. And it's not so much the intensity of the emotion, but whether that is prolonged. So a prolonged low or a prolonged really angry, that where they don't come out of that is a red flag. That's something that we look at. And then lastly, kind of day-to-day functioning. Is their functioning changing? Are they not able to sleep? Is their eating changing? Are they socially withdrawing, again, for more extended period of time? Are they not wanting to go to school? Is there a big change in the way in which they're engaging with their schoolwork? Those would be red flags, certainly for teens. For younger kids, it looks slightly different.
Yeah, what does it look like for younger
kids?
It
looks slightly different, but we're still looking for those same mm-hmm. things. So the big changes in their behavior, the no longer wanting to do preferred activities. I play football every day and now I don't want to play it for a prolonged period of time. The big changes in behaviors, the lack of sleep. You know, we often say, check the medical first, like get a blood panel done, talk to your GP, especially if you're younger kids. If we're noticing not wanting to get out of bed for prolonged periods of time, not eating or quitting.
Waking up in the middle of the night and mowing an entire bag of chips.
Yes.
That happened to one of my kids. And I could tell he was really stressed out about local school. That was how I knew mm-hmm. that this was not a good fit mm-hmm. for him.
Yeah. And that's where it's tricky. And I think that's where awareness of our kids is really important. We had a big change in one of our kids when she was younger, and it turned out that one of her vitamins was really low. As psychologists, when I work private practice and in the schools, I often encourage families to connect with their GP, say, hey, this is kind of what's going on, so that we can make sure we rule out that medical piece, especially as they're growing and developing. Vitamins sometimes can get a little bit outside of where they're supposed to be, and that can have a large impact on how they're presenting social emotional wise.
And that's just a perfect example, because like, let's say with the kid who wakes up in the middle of the night mm-hmm. or isn't sleeping and getting up and waking mm-hmm. up the house and come downstairs and like an entire bag of Doritos is eaten. You know, as a parent, the first thing I think is like, why are you doing that? That's wrong. You're in trouble. Don't do that. But really, it's a communication I am really stressed out and not coping with the situation.
It comes back to what is underlying that behavior. Behavior being communication. And so what is causing you to wake up in the middle of the night with that level of anxiety mm-hmm. that you're trying to soothe through eating and understanding what's going on around that. Sleep as well. It's such a tricky thing for teens, because it becomes more of a battle for some parents as they get older. But when you're not getting enough sleep, that impacts everything. It impacts your ability to regulate your emotions, to concentrate, to focus, to pay attention. Unless you're getting good quality sleep, you don't have the foundations in place for having good mental health.
What do you think about giving your kids some melatonin or magnesium if you know they're just kind of a bad sleeper?
One of mine takes magnesium. It's through her doctor. For me, it's about understanding the underlying reason why and having the conversation both with their doctors and with them about it. So magnesium for my daughter has been helpful, and it's guided through her doctor.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's really, there's no kind of don't do this, do that. For some people, magnesium, melatonin, those sorts of things can be tremendously helpful. Some people do guided meditation before they go to sleep, or they have particular sleep hygiene rituals. There's no kind of definitely do or definitely don't. But the one thing I would say to parents is that if your child is not getting enough sleep, that is a problem that you need to together with your child solve, because it has domino effect in other areas of their life.
Also, what about resources? So it's past things going sideways, mm-hmm. bad things are happening and you need help. If you are an ISL student, what are your resources? If you're not, if you're in Luxembourg, what are the resources?
We can talk first about what is available in school and then within the broader community, because we work very hard to establish good relationships with outside professionals and outside organizations and government organizations to support our students. So in the school, both in the lower school and in the upper school, firstly, we have advisors, homeroom advisors in the upper school and homeroom teachers in the lower school. So you have an adult who is looking at their child pastorally and keeping an eye out for them. And they often are one of the first people that might alert us to the fact that there might be a mental health challenge or a struggle that that child's going through. There's social emotional counselors within the school environment. So there's counseling on site, and that can be accessed either depending on the age of the child. More in the upper school, kids can access that service independently by going to speak to one of them or make an appointment. Parents can reach out and say, I've got a concern for my child, and come in and meet. I know, Beth, in the lower school, you do a lot of working with parents about their child's mental health.
Each grade level in the lower school has a counselor assigned that pastorally gives lessons and supports a grade level.
And then we have other pastoral structures in place. So we have grade leaders who are looking out for the cohort's well-being. So we're also looking at trends within that group of students, particular issues that they might be facing, that changes developmentally, as Beth mentioned, things like there's a certain age where kids start getting phones or they start getting onto social media, and that creates a whole load of other challenges. So we also have people looking at the trends of the cohort and putting in psychoeducational support there. So they have a well-being program that has specific lessons to support mental health. And so those teachers are also available. So within the school environment, we have a pretty robust pastoral care system, and we have very specific education that we give kids so that they can identify themselves when they might need help and how to access that help, and specific skills and strategies. Some of the, you know, the zones of regulation explicitly taught in the lower school, it's explicitly taught in the upper school. It looks different because the kids are developmentally at different phases, but that emotional literacy and positive coping strategies is something that runs throughout the school. External services that are available, and we often will suggest to families or make that available to them, because many families don't know where to turn, particularly for services in English. If they are only English speaking, that can be really, really difficult to navigate in Luxembourg. So I work more within the tween and teen years. And so we work a lot with the service Impulse, which is a counseling service for addiction and substance abuse. And so if that's a concern, we have people that we can get on the phone and say, this is a, you know, we have a student who needs support with this. They provide individual and group counseling, and they work with families. Mental health services, we work a lot with the Adolescent Mental Health Unit, with the Hôpital de Jour, the day clinic for students that might need inpatient care. We work with individual psychologists and psychiatrists. We don't recommend any particular psychologist or psychiatrist, also because different fits for different families. But we have a range of people that might be available. I think in the lower school, there we also have an OT, and there's other services there.
Yeah, so in the lower school, we have an occupational therapist who really supports sensory and emotion regulation, teaching kids kind of the awareness of their body and really looking at that aspect in addition to the lessons by the counselors around safeguarding and how to stay safe, but also the social emotional, from looking at supports for outside support. O&E is one that we refer families to.
That's the Office National de l'Enfance.
Mm-hmm. All of these we're going to put in the show notes. We're going to get the links to the government external things and put them in the show notes so anyone can access them.
So we also provide families with a list of, based on the SLP website, that have English speaking psychologists. And again, we refer a lot to the family general practice doctors of, hey, here's the things we're seeing. Reach out to your family doctor and engaging in those conversations. And how does that look? And then the other piece that we offer is the parenting classes to really help parents navigate.
Are those open to just ISL parents, or can anyone come?
At the moment, it's just ISL.
Okay.
We do have parent workshops that are, some of them are open to the broader English-speaking community. So, for example, we invite Impulse to come in and talk, and we open that up to all English-speaking parents in Luxembourg. That's something that we did last year that was well-received, and we will do again this year. We often have workshops around neurodiversity that we open up to the broader English-speaking community. So there are quite a few parent workshops that we try and make accessible to as many parents as possible, even if your child's not at ISL. But the parenting course is quite a specific course, and it's over a prolonged period of time, and that is only for ISL parents because there's a lot of demand for that as well.
Is that the positive parenting one?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that happening?
Yeah, it'll be happening February, March.
So amazing. Okay.
It'll be coming up.
Anything else that you guys want to say before we go?
Parenting is hard. It's really hard. It's certainly the hardest thing I've ever done. And that one thing that I think is really important is for parents to have their own good support network, to have someone that you as a parent can talk to about the challenges of being a parent and seek support from, and also have your own feelings validated and have, you know, parents need support as much as kids need support. And it's so easy to think that everybody else is getting it right and everyone else has got all the meals and it's all bio and everyone else has got their juggling all these balls and you know what's happening in your house and in my house, it's often chaos. Unless you have a good support network that you can turn to and go, this happened today. I didn't show up in the way I would like. I really screwed that up. And have someone go, I know, it's hard. Isn't it hard? And feel validated in that journey. I don't think we were ever meant to do parenting alone. And that we really need parents to also support each other. And if you are a parent who's struggling and you're worried about your kids' mental health, to really reach out to people around you and seek support. Often we feel embarrassed or we feel ashamed. We feel that we're doing something wrong if our kid is struggling. And it's so helpful to know that we all struggle as parents, even if it looks like the person next to you is good. Yeah. When I hear Beth talk about her family meetings and stuff, I have to remind myself, it's like, I'm not doing all of that. And that's okay. And I can learn from that and I can take from that. I'm sure there's times that Beth also feels like somebody else has got all their stuff together. Yes, you know, they're doing this so well. And that's not the case. So parents need to develop their own support networks as well.
And I think giving ourselves grace. Understanding, like if you listen to this and you're like, yeah, I haven't done any of those things, that's okay. It's also good for our modeling for our kids of like, hey, I'm learning things and I'm then using that and let's talk about it and really model that and giving ourselves the grace. There are times like this morning I was frustrated. I was like, we need to leave. I have a meeting at 7:30. We need to get out the door. And that used the tone. I'm like, oh man, I shouldn't have said it like that. And we got in the car and it was Mom, you're in a really bad mood. And I was like, no, I just need it. And it was like, okay, I'm really sorry. Mom needed to get out of the house. There was a lot going on. When you're sitting there on your phone, after I've asked you to put it away, I got frustrated. And it's just modeling those skills. And they know like, oh, we all make mistakes. We're learning on it. And that's where I think a lot of the growth comes from in building a family too.
Getting out of the house is hard. It just is.
Amen to that.
How do you celebrate a failure in your house? Like specifically, is there like a cake involved? Like what happened?
No, we just say like last week we were talking about it and I was like, I was supposed to have this teaching and learning handbook done by this time. I didn't get it done. Here's what I did. I went to Joey, said, hey, I need this. And so we talk about, yes, I made this mistake. I own this mistake. And here's how I'm going to fix it. And so it really is just modeling. Sometimes if I notice something's happening with one of my kids, I'm like, yeah, you haven't done anything that I've asked. The back talk is, then I will like model that. I'll be like, I was in a meeting. I got frustrated. I used a tone that I didn't really shouldn't have used with a colleague. Here's what I've done. And sometimes my kids now pick it up and like, oh, Mom is saying that she doesn't like my tone.
Oh, wow.
And so there's different ways. There are times when, you know, you obviously pick and choose which failures we're going to celebrate. Sometimes we will talk about conflict that my husband and I have. I wasn't listening to your dad and he was trying to tell me something really important and I was more interested in the book I was reading. And so we do talk about some of that. So sometimes we will model specific things if we are picking up that maybe we need to have a family conversation about a behavior. Or I will talk about a failure that I did in a conversation with them. It's like, you know, I realized it's really important that I use the same tone that I want you to use with me. And when I spoke to you, I was quite cross and the message was what I wanted to get across, but the way I said it wasn't the way I wanted to say it. That's a part of it. And in our house, we say a fail is a first attempt in learning. And so it's really using some of that.
When you start saying these things, though, be warned that your kid is going to bring them back to you. So the other day, and we spent a lot of time saying that failures are learning opportunities. And then I really messed something up and I've got this dialogue going that it was so stupid of me. I can't believe I did that. and little 8-year-old's voice going, but mom, you said that failure is an opportunity for learning. And you said that we shouldn't talk to ourselves like that. That comes back to bite you as well. But yeah, I think there are different ways to celebrate learning. It's also about how you reframe that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. You guys, I think we're going to leave it there.
Awesome.
Thank you. Beth and Patricia, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Mom Life in Luxembourg. If you like the show, I'd love to hear from you. Please feel free to leave a comment, or better yet, share with another mom friend. And if there's a topic you'd like to see covered or you want to be on the show yourself, please email me at momlife@rtl.lu. And if you're feeling social, you can always reach me on Facebook and Instagram at Mom Life in Luxembourg. Thanks so much and have a great day.